Our next speaker is Bob Alvarez from the Institute of Policy Studies. He's a senior scholar at the Institute of Policy Studies, where he's currently focused on nuclear disarmament, environmental and energy policies. Between 1993 and 1999, Mr. Alvarez served as senior policy advisor to the Secretary and Deputy Assistant Secretary for National Security and the Environment. While at the Department of Energy, he coordinated the effort to enact nuclear worker compensation legislation. In 1994 and 95, he led teams in North Korea to establish control of nuclear weapons materials. He coordinated nuclear materials strategic planning for the department and established the department's first asset management program. Bob was awarded two secretarial gold medals, the highest awards given by the Department of Energy. In 1975, Bob helped found and direct the Environmental Policy Institute, EPI, a respected national public interest organisation. And I just would mention Kitty Tucker is here, who is Bob's wife, and it's her birthday today. Bob.
As is my proclivity, I like to jam as much information as I can into presentations. So about a week or so ago, I sent Helen a bunch of slides that took up about 2 hours. And she was very polite about it. But I didn't know, I did it deliberately to pull her leg, but she was very polite about it. So what I've done, I've had to sort of downsize this. And so in lieu of better words, put your trays in an upright position, put your seatbelts on. Here we go. As some of you are, you know, is that in the spring of this year, the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty Review Conference will take place. It occurs every 5 years, and now it's been agreed upon to do this indefinitely every 5 years at the United Nations in New York City. And the treaty was essentially adopted and enacted into force in 1970, and it was essentially an interesting product of consensus amongst the Cold War rivals between Russia or Soviet Union and the United States. And it has three basic pillars to it. One is the nuclear weapon states that were identified as official at that time: the United States, Soviet Union, Russia, United Kingdom, France, and China would undertake good faith efforts for the complete disarmament, nuclear disarmament, and general disarmament. The second pillar was that countries could have the right to seek to develop the peaceful uses of nuclear energy, and then the third pillar was that those who did would forswear developing nuclear weapons, would agree to undergo international safeguards and security. Now, there are other provisions of this treaty which we're now growing to regret. For example, Article 5 approved of peaceful nuclear explosions. Some of you may not remember that. Something that India did in 1974, declared it a peaceful nuclear explosion, but it didn't pass the LAAF test. The other is Article 10, which gives nations the, quote, inalienable, unquote, right to develop uranium enrichment and reprocessing. These are very proliferation-sensitive technologies. Nuclear power in and of itself is inherently a dual-use technology that can be used to develop nuclear weapons. It was recognized as such very early on. Most people don't realize that the first major generator of nuclear-powered electricity was essentially a dual-purpose reactor operated at the Hanford site between 1963 and 87. It was the largest producer of nuclear electricity in the 1960s, and it was also producing plutonium for the U.S. nuclear weapons program. We also have reprocessing. This is an overhead shot here of the Purex reprocessing plant in Yongbyon in North Korea. And we also have enrichment of uranium involving centrifuges and other technologies. I'm going to give you a quiz on this one. I apologize. I should have put this in a more understandable form. But this particular table addresses the issue of how much plutonium is being generated by commercial nuclear power plants or nuclear power plants worldwide by design, by reactor type. The key to nuclear nonproliferation is not access to knowledge, it's access to the actual explosive materials. This is the essential safeguard that is required. The secrets of how to make nuclear weapons are not so secret anymore. The technologies, while some of them are hard to come by, can be obtained, but it's the actual materials, especially plutonium, highly enriched uranium, and in certain cases, uranium-233. These are what are known as fissile materials or nuclear explosive materials. What this graph basically shows is that roughly one out of every five reactors in operation right now that are generating nuclear power worldwide are based on original designs to produce plutonium for nuclear weapons. The top one, the PHWR, which is pressurized heavy water reactor, this was a design, it was a workhorse for the United States nuclear weapons program at the Savannah River site. Most of these reactors are in Canada. They're called CANDU reactors. But this particular reactor provided India with its plutonium for its first nuclear weapons. It's providing Pakistan with its plutonium for nuclear weapons. And if you see the numbers here, it is a very, very efficient plutonium producer. It's producing about twice as much weapons-usable plutonium than our commercial nuclear power plants, pressurized water, boiling water reactors. The RBMK beneath that is essentially a graphite-moderated water-cooled reactor that are operating in Russia right now. This is the so-called Chernobyl-style reactor. They stole this design from the United States, and we were operating nine such reactors at the Hanford site. To produce plutonium, we produced about 67.4 metric tons using this particular design reactor. Then in the following down, you have the pressurized water reactors and the boiling water reactors, which really make up the great majority of reactors worldwide. And then you have the gas-cooled reactors. These are graphite-moderated gas-cooled reactors. These are reactors that fueled the British, French, North Korean, and Israeli nuclear weapons programs. They are generating electricity. They are part of the mix of global nuclear power. As you see this number here at the very, where it says global annual plutonium discharge in red, nuclear power plants worldwide, there are about 427 of them. They are generating roughly 100 metric tons of plutonium a year, weapons-usable plutonium a year. And when all is said and done, when this spent fuel is discharged from a reactor, it's as you may know, is very highly radioactive, very difficult to handle. But after a period of several hundred years, what's really left over is the plutonium. And this becomes really a long-term concern. What will we be doing with all this plutonium that we've been generating worldwide? The major challenges we face here, well, first of all, North Korea withdrew from the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. They've tested three nuclear weapons so far and threatened to unravel the nuclear nonproliferation regime of the Far East. Iran, where, as you know, we're in the process of trying to negotiate an agreement, we being five nations led by the United States, to somehow come to an agreement that would limit the degree and extent of uranium enrichment that Iran would develop in order to provide a nuclear fuel for its research program and its power program. I think we should not in any way discount the Chernobyl and Fukushima nuclear disasters. I think they play a very big role. They play a very, very big role in how we deal with nuclear dangers, and we have to start to bring nuclear safety much more to the forefront and recognize that these are type of reactors that deal literal body blows to entire nations. We have nuclear weapon states outside of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, such as Israel, India, Pakistan, Democratic People's of Republic of Korea, all operating in unstable regions with long histories of conflict. Pakistan right now is producing more nuclear weapons than any other nation in the world. They're spending somewhere between $2.5 to $3 billion a year on making nuclear weapons. We've had basically a glacial pace in terms of U.S. and Russia nuclear arms reductions and the stalling of multilateral nuclear agreements such as a fissile material cutoff treaty. We have the risk of terrorist threat from unsecured fissile materials. President Obama has made it a high priority for nuclear security of these materials. But if you look very carefully at what we're talking about here in terms of preventing people from getting their hands on these materials and making bombs and committing acts of malice. What we are doing is cleaning up after the Atoms for Peace parade. The United States distributed a huge amount of highly enriched uranium worldwide in order to foster development of nuclear energy. We sent it to places like Congo in Katanga province, where we still have some HEU there, and we haven't yet been able to retrieve it. We have the total discriminatory nature of safeguards and security under this treaty between nuclear weapon states and non-weapon states, which is a sort of do as I say but not as I do, which is a source of inherent tension. The nuclear weapon states, the United States, the UK, Russia, France, and China, really are steadfastly opposed to undergoing the same level of scrutiny of their programs as those entities that we suspect might want to be developing nuclear weapons. And then at the same time, the United States is sending really mixed signals to other countries pursuing proliferation-sensitive technologies. In 1970, the year that the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty entered into force, then chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission, Glenn Seaborg, estimated that by the end of the 20th century, there would be 1,000 reactors dotting the American landscape. There would be a commensurately large number of reactors worldwide, that the world would exhaust its supplies of uranium, and that by this time, the U.S. reactors alone would require 1,600 tons of plutonium to sustain their future. As some of you know, it takes 4 to 6 kilograms. The amount of plutonium that was detonated over Nagasaki was 6 kilograms. We've sort of greatly reduced that since then, but 4 to 6 kilograms. So at that time, he was basically promoting the idea that we would have literally at least 1,600 tons of plutonium floating through international commerce. And think about just a small, tiny fraction of that amount of plutonium somehow being diverted and stolen. We still are pursuing these technologies, albeit in a lower level. For many years, the United States was one of the principal supporters of what they call the closed nuclear fuel cycle. This was based, again, on the whole notion that we would have such spectacular nuclear power growth that we would run out of uranium, and therefore we had to establish another form of nuclear fuel, namely plutonium. And the idea here was that the irradiated fuel would be removed from the reactor once after a certain period of time. It would be sent to a chemical separations plant where the plutonium and uranium would be extracted. The plutonium and uranium would be, quote, recycled and put back into reactors, except these would be a different kind of reactors known as fast reactors, because these reactors, in order to have significant quantities of plutonium in them, need fast neutrons to generate the energy necessary to provide electricity, as opposed to the reactors we now have, which are based on thermal neutrons or slow neutrons. I attended a hearing once when I first got started about a fast reactor, and a gentleman from the Atomic Energy Commission was being questioned about what would happen if you lost the coolant. The coolant of these reactors is basically liquid sodium. And if you know anything about liquid sodium, if it comes into contact with air, it basically spontaneously combusts. And so this senator asked this government witness, well, what would happen if you had a loss of coolant in one of his reactors? And his reply was, well, we might have a rapid energetic disassembly. This idea has been kicked around and is still kicked around. The United Kingdom has pretty much quit. They are stuck with a bunch of plutonium that they don't know what to do with. France is sort of limping around with a large amount of excess separated plutonium with no credible disposition. Japan is reeling from the Fukushima disaster, and it remains to be seen whether they'll really be able to establish a plutonium economy. And Russia is still waving the flag and the only one operating a breeder reactor right now. The rationale for using this type of reactor has changed because, you know, it's obvious that we have not run out of uranium, and nuclear power growth projections were underestimated by an order of magnitude. And so it was then thought about, well, these reactors would help us reduce the amount of waste that would have to be disposed of by transmuting them into less troublesome isotopes. In 1996, while I was in the Energy Department, we asked the National Academy of Sciences to look at this. We asked the National Academy of Sciences to look into this, and they reported that if everything worked, using the spent fuel from the existing nuclear power fleet, it would take about $740 billion in 2014 dollars and take 150 years to accomplish the transmutation of the plutonium. But it still goes on. The open nuclear fuel cycle is what we pursue right now, which is that we irradiate the spent fuel, we store it, and over time, if things work out, which they haven't for the last 50 or so years, we would dispose of this in a geologic repository. Assuming a large capacity worldwide of nuclear power, we will have reached about 20,000 metric tons of plutonium worldwide. This gives you an idea of global nuclear power perspective. The third graph, which is Japan, you have to understand that all those reactors are shut down right now. But this tells you a lot about where nuclear power is and who has the most and where things stand. This is a graph that shows you the accumulation of spent fuel inventories by the year between 1990 and by the year 2030. And so that spent fuel will accumulate approximately 5,000 metric tons of plutonium worldwide. This is another graph that gives you an idea of the age of the reactors because, as you see, the majority of the existing reactors are between 27 and 34 years old, and being able to backfill that is going to be an enormous challenge. And despite the claims about this rather spectacular growth of nuclear power, it really remains to be seen. This is essentially a projection by the IAEA of nuclear growth worldwide. And really, the one takeaway I have from this is that the top part of the bar graphs basically tell you that China is a place where nuclear power growth is expected to be significant. But beyond that, how much nuclear power will China develop really is depending on a lot of factors. This is a graph about the United States nuclear weapons program. I publish a regular column in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. And this shows the budget projections from fiscal year 2014 to the year 2020 of the weapons activities program of the Energy Department. What percentage of the Energy Department's budget do you think goes for actual energy activities? What do you think? Any thought? About 15%. Two-thirds of the Energy Department's budget is for babysitting nuclear weapons, maintaining the nuclear arsenal, and cleaning up the mess that was created by generating these weapons. That's what two-thirds of the Energy Department's budget is about. What this shows you here in terms of the colors of this, once you start to, with the exception of these turquoise little bands, that's transportation, we spend about $250 million a year to move around nuclear weapons and nuclear weapons parts. If you take those little blue bands out and everything above the red is to keep the lights on. We're looking at an antiquated, oversized infrastructure that is costing at least 40% of the annual budgets just to keep the lights on for the nuclear weapons production complex. One thing I did is I decided to ask myself, well, if this were a business, what would be the per unit cost of nuclear weapons if you looked at the costs of maintaining an average warhead on an annual basis? And I looked at what it was 30 years ago when we had a large number of nuclear weapons. We had about something like 23,000 nuclear weapons, and what we have now, which is 7,300 nuclear weapons. And basically, the number of nuclear weapons dropped by 300% since 1985. The per unit cost of nuclear weapons has increased by 500% over the same time period. So we're getting more bucks for the bang here. This is one of the big dilemmas, I think, that we have to come to terms with, which is the large excess stockpiles of plutonium that have no credible disposition. The bar graphs in green are those stocks of plutonium that have been generated for civilian purposes. The black is for nuclear weapons purposes. We, the United States, are now trying to figure out a way to get rid of roughly 50 metric tons of excess plutonium that was part of our strategic nuclear stockpile. Basically, it's estimated to cost about $30 billion. Plutonium has a negative value. It has no inherent value. So anytime you use it as a fuel, you're losing money. It's like it's the economics of sunk costs. We are also pushing the technology envelope in a way that I think will make the world a more dangerous place. We're beginning to, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is in the process of licensing the initial development of a new form of uranium enrichment involving the molecular level separation through lasers, tunable dye lasers, of uranium. This is called Silex, and we're looking now at enrichment facilities that used to consume a footprint of around 30 acres for the building to something that could be put into a Costco warehouse that would have no really serious footprint that could be detected using national means. It would use far less energy, would not have the chemical signatures you would expect to find for an enrichment plant. Our Nuclear Regulatory Commission is refusing to perform a non-proliferation assessment of this technology and letting GE move forward. In the meantime, by the way, speaking of which mixed signals, the Republic of Korea, South Korea, we have a bilateral agreement with South Korea for nuclear cooperation, and that agreement is expiring this year, and the big issue is the Republic of Korea wants to be able to develop and acquire reprocessing technology because their spent fuel inventories are increasing and the public's becoming restive and very unhappy about all this nuclear waste piling up, and they figure, well, we'll quote, solve the nuclear waste problem. The State Department, to its credit, is arguing that no, they should not be allowed to reprocess, and they consider these 123 agreements, they're under Section 123 of the Atomic Energy Act, that they consider the gold standard is for a country to agree with the United States to forego reprocessing and enrichment. In the meantime, in the Department of Energy's budget, we're spending $35 million to help the Republic of Korea develop reprocessing technologies. This is going on as we speak. This is an example of what we call no adult supervision inside the U.S. government. We have really serious unfinished business of nuclear arms control and disarmament, a fissile material cutoff treaty, which is a multilateral effort. The major nuclear weapons states, the five declared nuclear weapons states, have stopped producing fissile materials for nuclear weapons for quite a long time now. We just simply stopped. We've got so much we don't know what to do with. The one of the insane things about nuclear deterrence by the early mid-1980s was that nuclear deterrence was actually being explicitly described in the terms of the winner of a nuclear exchange would be the one that had the most nuclear weapons left over. The United States and the former Soviet Union and Russia, I think, engaged in a grave strategic error in overbuilding its nuclear arsenals, and these are turning into giant millstones around our neck. We haven't a clue of how to really get rid of them in any significant way, but we have to start doing this. The Obama administration has a policy, now that the Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference is up, the Obama administration has a quiet policy that it will not dismantle any of the weapons that it retires from the New START agreement until a new refurbished nuclear weapons complex is established sometime in the 2030s. This is the message that the United States is sending to the rest of the world at the NPT Review Conference. Not only that, the U.S. Government Accountability Office reported last year that the Department of Energy, National Nuclear Security Energy Agency, does not track the dates of their retired weapons. Can you imagine this practice happening in a grocery store? I mean, it isn't like, you know, some fancy thing to track the dates. And not only that, the GAO pointed out that the NNSA is quietly reinstating hundreds of warheads to the stockpile. The stockpile is actually growing, and we're not doing any adult supervision over this. And the Fissile Material Cutoff Treaty, it's not surprising that Pakistan, in particular, is playing a key role in trying to block this. In conclusion, there are several challenges that threaten to unravel the nuclear nonproliferation regime in regions of long-standing conflict, particularly the Far East and the Middle East. Many non-nuclear weapon states at the NPT review conference will protest and have protested the lack of progress being made by weapon states. There's no good reason why the United States cannot take down literally thousands of its nuclear weapons. It currently has about 60% of the total number of intact weapons that are not deployed. 40% have been effectively retired. But we are sort of in the business of hoarding. Some of you may be familiar with the term of the cargo cults. These were the primitive Stone Age people who encountered industrial societies in the 20th century in the Pacific, like Borneo and elsewhere. And the Japanese and the Allies eventually showed up mostly during World War II with airplanes, guns, metal, knives, mirrors, uniforms, boats, things that they couldn't believe. And then the war ended and everybody left. And anthropologists came back several years later and observed that some of these cultures were doing things like carefully preserving the runways, the docks. They had their religious leaders, their shaman or a priest, whatever you want to call them, conducting religious ceremonies in uniforms, stamping pieces of paper. And they were asked, well, why are you doing this? It's because the gods had come. And if we don't preserve this, they'll never come back. And they were called cargo cults. I contend that we are maintaining a very large and expensive cargo cult in our nuclear weapons program. I sort of go through a shopping list of steps that are needed to strengthen a non-proliferation treaty. I won't sort of go over all these things, but there are several things that can be done to sort of tighten that treaty, but I think it's important to recognize that this treaty is not the end-all to be-all. It really depends, I think, largely on the United States and the nuclear weapons states to demonstrate real serious commitment and leadership in eliminating nuclear weapons. Thank you.